Okay. So the first question I would ask is, who wants to be a better person tomorrow? Meaning, do we want to advance in this world? Advance as a human being, as a person? And I think most people would say they do. And the question is, where can we go and how could we get there? Person comes into yeshiva and he sees, okay, there are a lot of people learning, there are a lot of books to learn, there are a lot of aspects in which a person can perfect oneself. What's my potential? How far can I get? Most people feel like there's a cap. Like, I could get this much, I could get that much. I don't know how many stories you've heard about the different great people we've had in our tradition, and even a rabbi who lived in this past century was once, he got a ride, and you know the story? He was grabbing the buckle, someone closed the door on his hand.
No.
He didn't say a word, and as the driver drove on, and then after they were like a block away, he said, could you stop for a second? He stopped, he opened the door and pulled his hand in. He didn't want to shame the person. The person had known that he had closed the door on this rabbi's hand. Self-control and a lot of good traits. I mean, there are stories. We could spend the whole day now talking about stories that we have from rabbis in this century, or rabbis in the last century, or rabbis in the Talmud. So, what is our potential, and how do we get there? So, the first thing I think we have to know is what it says in the Rambam. When it comes to greatness, every one of us has potential to reach Moshe Rabbeinu. Meaning, the potential is limitless. Now, you can't say everyone. Some people were given limited intelligence. Some people were given limited capacity. But in general, our approach is within the concept of Bechira Chofshit, free will. And God gave each of us potential to grow and grow to the highest levels. The question is, how much effort will we put in? It's true that different people are in different situations. A guy who's coming out of the jungles of Africa, he has to first discover what civilization means. He's going to have to work a little bit harder. But at the end of the day, we could all get there. And we're not judged based on someone else. We're judged based on ourselves. Meaning, there's a famous line by Rav Zusha. He said, when I get to heaven, I'm not worried they'll ask me, why weren't you Maimonides? I'll say, well, I didn't have the tools Maimonides had. I'm not worried they'll ask me, why weren't you Rashi? I'll say, well, I didn't have the tools Rashi had. I'm worried they'll ask me, why weren't you Rav Zusha? Why wasn't I myself? Meaning, we're all gauged based on our own potential. But our own potential is very great. Not only is it great with regard to ourselves, but we also have on tradition that every Jew has a section in Torah that only he can discover. And if he discovers it, that Torah will come to the world. And if he doesn't discover it, then that Torah will not come to the world. Hashem made the Torah in a way that every student, every person who learns Torah in a true way, can discover true new insights into the Torah that no one before him discovered. It says that when Moshe was up in heaven for the 40 days and 40 nights, God taught him what every student would still ultimately discover. Moshe didn't pass that on. Boketov. But we have, and it says in Tehillim in the very first chapter also, that every person specifically has potential. The Torah is considered every person's individual gift. Meaning, there's the Torah that discusses how you keep Shabbat, and there's the Torah that discusses how we're supposed to honor our parents. But then when you go a little bit deeper, there are insights that only specific people can discover. Every one of us has parts of Torah that if we're going to uncover, they'll become uncovered, and if not, they're going to remain. So the first thing we have to know is the potential. Hashem put a tremendous potential inside each person. And the question is, where will we get there? The same thing when we talk about traits. You guys know the story of Megillas Esther, right? So Esther's in the king's palace. She spent 3 years in hiding. Finally, they abducted her. They took her in. Now she spends 12 months in preparation. And then, against her will, she's dragged to the king's palace, and the king falls in love with her. She spends the next 5 years being married to him. And every time, it's against her will. Now, we have to remember that Esther was a Nevi'ah, a prophetess. And then In a minute we'll discuss the relevance of that. Esther was among the most pious women that ever lived. For Esther to be in Ahasuerus' palace was sheer torture. So 5 years she's undergoing this torture. She has to live with a man she doesn't want to live with. And then, it's the 12th year of his reign, we have the decree by Haman, and Mordechai tells her, you have to go into Ahasuerus. You have to see if you could get him to annul the decree. Esther says, you know, if I go in uninvited, then the way things stand now, anyone who walks in uninvited to his chambers gets killed. He could say, no, don't kill her, but I'm walking into a situation where there's certain death right now. Mordechai tells her, you guys know what Mordechai tells her?
Do it anyways.
He says it, but he says it a little bit more strongly.
Like, I don't care.
No, says it a little bit more strongly than that. Says, "Al tedami v'nafshech." Don't think to yourself, "Bimalet bet amelech mikol ha'yudim," that you in the palace, you'll make it out. All the other Jews are in danger, but you're okay because you're in the palace. Ki im acharesh tacharishi beit hazot. If you'll be silent at this time, revach v'atzala yamod la'yudim imakom acher. The Jews will be saved from a different venue. God isn't going to let the Jewish people be destroyed. But you and your father's house, you will be destroyed. What's Mordechai telling her?
The Jews will survive anyways, but she has a chance to make it up for her family.
Oh, he says, right, that's Chazal say that, right. That she has a chance to make it up for her family, and then he concludes with one powerful sentence. He says, "Umi yodeh," and who knows, "im le'et kazot higat la'malchut." Who knows that maybe the whole reason you became queen was for a time like this. Very often in life, we're challenged. A parent, a sibling, a relative, someone gets on our nerves. And it's difficult. You want to react. One of the keys is to remember, "Umi yodem net kazot." Maybe this is the time. Maybe, you know, this is the time I could stand up or not. There's a story. Rabbi Yoshua once asked God, who's going to be his neighbor in the world to come? So he was shown an individual, and he couldn't figure out. The guy was a simple butcher. So he followed him. He couldn't figure out what was so special about him. He was the rabbi learning, teaching Torah, and this butcher is going to be his neighbor in the world to come. So finally, he goes over to the butcher and he tells him, "Could you tell me a little bit about your history, where you've been, what you've been up to?" So he tells him, "I'm a simple butcher. I don't do anything special." He says, "No, you must have done something special in your life. What can you tell me?" So he says, "Yeah, there was once a group of bandits that came through town, and they had people that they had captured and they were selling into slavery. And I saw among the people that they captured a young girl. And she said to me, 'I'm Jewish, buy me.' So I said, 'Fine, if you say you're Jewish.' I bought her from the bandits, and I took her into my house, and I raised her as my own daughter. And then I called my son in, and I said, 'Look, she's an orphan, we have no clue where she comes from. And marry her, let's bring her up, let's help her out.' And my son said, 'Dad, if you say it's a good idea, I'm with you.' So we set up the wedding, and I took out loans, and I took out money, and I set up a whole tremendous wedding. And then came the wedding day, and I invited poor people to eat at the wedding, and I set everything up, and everyone was sitting and feasting, and we're getting ready for the wedding to begin. And a man is sitting at one table crying. So I walk over to him, and I say, 'Sir, welcome to town. Who are you, and why are you weeping?' So the man says, 'I'm from a faraway town. I've been searching for this girl for ages. I was legally married to her. I have here the marriage contract. This is her real name. I was supposed to marry her. And her father already really wed her to me. And now this is her wedding. And I'll give you proof. I'll tell you all kinds of things about her that only I could know.' So the butcher hears all of this. He says, 'Okay.' He calls the son. And he tells him, 'Son, look, you listen to me. when I told you to marry her, now listen to me, I'm telling you, we'll get you a better girl. You can't marry her. Halachically, she's already engaged to someone else. Let's sing and dance and make someone else happy at this wedding. I'll make you a nice wedding. We took all the clothing we had prepared for him and gave it to this poor guy who came to the town. We took all the wedding and we sang and we danced and we married her off to him. And then we took them into the house, and for a few months until he was able to get on his own feet, we helped him out. So Rabbi Yeshua walked away. He said, okay, now I understand. On the one hand, learning Torah is considered the biggest mitzvah. But on the other hand, we find stories like this in Chazal that indicate to us that a person who's a good person can sometimes, if he stands up to the test of a specific moment, he could sometimes shine just like someone who grows in Torah. So we said today we're going to try to focus on traits, on midot. And I want to begin by asking a simple question. Which traits can you think of that a person can think to build himself? Which midot?
Kindness.
Go ahead.
Generosity.
Generosity. Okay, that's in Hebrew, nedivut. Yeah. That's it? That's all we got?
Kindness. Wait, thoughtful?
Yeah. That's it?
Empathy.
Ready?
Patience,
okay. Go ahead.
Stubbornness of justice.
Mm-hmm. What else? Yehuda, you want to help us? What about modesty? What about happiness? That's considered a
trait.
Yeah. Sameach, person who is happy, yeah. What about God fearing? Yad Shammai? Oh, so what is that? So Dafka, the one with which we should start. What does it mean to be God fearing? So why don't you define it first?
Fear of God would be the simplest explanation, maybe. The simplest definition.
Okay.
But that doesn't sound very nice to work on in fear. So it's not fear per se, because that wouldn't be a good thing. So it's more like something else.
Okay. What do you say? What does it mean?
Maybe a mixture of like respect and awe. Like that you are sort of like, wait, I haven't thought.
Oh.
What do you say, Gandhi? It's the same respect you give to a king. Like, you're not afraid of him, but doesn't mean that you're afraid of him, but it means that you give some kind of. The fear, it means that you respect him.
What do you say?
Yeah, that you believe in God and that you. You recognize him as the only truth, and that like he's in control of everything.
Okay, so Chazal tell us that there are levels, but first we have to define. In Hebrew, no two words mean exactly the same thing. There's the word yirah, there's the word pachad. There are two types of fear. There's fear, a person standing holding a gun opposite someone, he's scared right now he's going to get killed. Then there's fear, Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, fear of the potential. It's not a direct fear right now. There's a fear, we're told, Ishimov Aviv Tirau. We're supposed to fear our parents. We're not scared they're going to kill us. It's a certain respect, like you guys said. It's a certain subservience. But it's interesting, Chazal tell us that the first thing a person has to work on is to be a God-fearing person. And the last thing a person has to work on is to be a God-fearing person. So how can it be the first and the last? So Chazal say it has to be step number one. Without it, so why should I be a good person? You know, I once had a friend who was a very, very good person. And he saw a very harsh tragedy happen before his eyes. He saw a person be killed before his eyes, a person who he loved very much. And he walked away from that. He was a young kid. And he started questioning. Does God exist? Does God exist? How could I have seen that if God exists? If God exists, how could that have happened? And he spent the next 10 to 15 years questioning. And then he decided, okay, God doesn't exist. So I asked him, do you think you'll still be a good person if you've come to this conclusion? So he said, yeah, sure. And unfortunately, history has proven otherwise. When Avram comes to the town with Avimelech, right? So Avram says about Sarah, she's my sister. What do they tell him? Why'd you say she was your sister? We wouldn't have abducted her if we knew she was your wife. What does Avram answer them?
You would have killed me.
Why? Right? He says, I was scared you would have killed me because I noticed one thing about this place. What does he say? You guys remember? He says, I noticed there's no fear of God here. Avimelech says, what do you mean? We have laws here. We have a legal system. Avram says, I know how legal systems work. But in a legal system, you could kill. You find reasons to kill anyone. A legal system is not a moral system. It's something that theoretically could maintain morals, but not necessarily. So you'll tell me you didn't pay this tax, you passed up on this, you crossed the street on a red light. You'll find an excuse within the legal system to kill me. I know how legal systems work. I mean, I don't know if you guys, I don't know what you know about the legal system in Sweden, but in the United States and Israel, it's for sure that way. In Israel, they don't kill people, theoretically, at least not within the legal system, but the system definitely controls how it's run. I mean, so there's no point going into it, but it's known. The claim that Avram says is that there's no God-fearingness here. If you don't fear God, then all your laws, they're not backed up by anything. The most moral people, at least they claim to be the most moral people, were the Nazis. They set up a legal system. If the legal system is what defines morals, so then, okay, so they could decide. You know what? Humanity does not begin with people who are black. Humanity does not begin with people who are retarded. It doesn't begin with gypsies. It doesn't begin with Jews. Humanity is from this race upward. And they could define it, and it's all legal. So the core, at the root of really being a good person, is to recognize that God is running the world, and He gave us a legal system. He told us what's moral and what's not moral. The last century was focused, philosophers focused primarily on trying to prove a connection between logic and morals. That was the main focus of the 20th century philosophy. And basically, most philosophers came to the conclusion there is none. There's no way you could prove that killing someone is bad. What's wrong with killing someone? Logically, you can't prove it. There's something inside us that says it's wrong, but that's not logic. So let's work. Let's take the traits. God-fearingness is important. Do we have a basic understanding? Or not yet?
What did you say was the least important? Or the last?
What? It is the beginning, it is the first step, and it is the ultimate. It is both. Meaning without it, you cannot really advance within development of traits. And as you develop, as a person develops his own traits, so he ultimately he'll realize that he has to develop that as well. There are levels within that. There's the base level. There's a guy who walks into the hospital and he says, "Gosh, wow! At any moment, God could do this to me." So he's scared. And then there are higher levels of recognizing that God runs the world. There's awe, there's fear, there's respect. That's all levels of working within the system. But it all begins with the recognition that God exists, and then our relationship vis-a-vis God. What traits would you guys think we should talk about today? Oh, modesty. Okay. What do you say? If there's one trait, it's the ultimate trait. What would you say it is? Okay. Generosity. I have a question. Did you guys study the Megillah at all? The story of the Megillah this year? Here?
We've talked a little bit about some during.
So maybe we'll take the remaining 20 minutes to talk about the Megillah. You guys seem asleep. Huh? Yes? No? Okay. Okay, so first of all, we have to know the Talmud tells us that there is an evolvement. A person grows from trait to trait. And what's the ultimate trait? Chazal tells the ultimate trait is prophecy. But when a person perfects his trait, so then he comes close to God, to the level where God talks to him. So when we talk about a prophet, it's someone who's really perfected his traits. Now, what would you say is at the root of all traits? Meaning, there's knowledge. You have to know what it means to be a good person. I think we'd all agree that at the root of all traits is also self-control. Meaning, it's not enough. You could learn theoretically, yeah, it's a good thing to be kind, it's a good thing to be good, but generous. But if you don't have self-control, then why should a person do that? I want you guys to go with me 50, 60 years ago to a concentration camp, Bergen-Belsen. And the time is Christmas. And the Nazis bring in a special treat in honor of Christmas. They give all the people in the concentration camp, they give them, it's not exactly jello, it's fruits that are have been cooked in sugar. I don't know what you call that. So they give that out to the people in the camp. And there are two girls who aren't even related, they're just good friends. And one turns to the other and says, I left mine up over there for you because you're weak, you need it more than I do, so it's waiting for you over the beam over there. And the second one says to the first one, she says, yeah, and I hid mine over there behind the beam because I figured you need it more than I do, and so I'm waiting for you to eat it, take yours and take mine. You need the strength. And they argued it out. After a few minutes, they couldn't come to a conclusion. So they went to sleep. And the next morning, they started arguing again. You eat both of them. No, you eat both of them. No, you eat both of them. And it went back and forth this way for 3 days until the things really turned moldy. There was nothing to discuss. I heard this story from one of the women who was involved in the argument. And she told me that in the camps, the people who last, one of the things that ensured a person would last was if he was looking out for others or if he was only looking out for himself. those who worked together, and those two both made it. I know both women. They're both, Baruch Hashem, still alive and well with grandchildren. They both made it. But I think a person has to ask himself, when push comes to shove, what would a person do? Meaning, it's very easy today that we have everything is easy. We have ragalach, we have cake, we have cookies. So yeah, you could offer the next guy. It's easy to forgo it. But what keeps a person moral when things get tough? Meaning, when life is demanding, what makes a person moral? And I think when we think about that, we'll see that there's self-control, but there's also Yirat Shemayim, the concept of being God-fearing. Because if I recognize that God is here, so then I have all the reason in the world to behave the way I should. It doesn't matter what life puts in front of us. If God is not in the room, so then it's survival of the fittest. So then it's a dog-eat-dog world. Then we all start being dogs. Chazal tell us that the ultimate trait is the trait you mentioned earlier, anava, modesty. How do you understand that? What's at the root of modesty? And let's take the opposite trait, because we could always understand the trait when we look at both. Modesty and pride.
Modesty and
pride. Haughtiness. Let's take an example. I was talking to a doctor last week. He's interviewing in different facilities. Told me he walked into one facility, they offered him a tremendous paycheck, and he started working with them to see if he wants to work there, and he sees that all the doctors around him think they're God. Literally. You can't argue with them, you have no one to talk to. They're God. And the patients also have no one to talk to. Now this is an age-old problem, that doctors are haughty. Not all doctors are, but some are, because everyone needs them. I mean, if someone needs you because you're a plumber, you could have some level of haughtiness. If someone needs you for his life, so it's very easy to become very haughty. So, what's at the root of haughtiness? Why do these doctors feel like they're God? Any suggestions?
Because they can.
Because they're the only ones.
Life and death.
Chazal tells that at the root of haughtiness is a lie, and at the root of modesty is truth. Meaning, the fact that they could do it, they got the training. Someone else got the training. Maybe they'd be better than them. How much can they take credit for it? Their parents paid them through medical school, society paid. There's very little that a person can take credit for at the end of the day. Any minute that a person sits and says, me, what he's saying is he's taking credit for things that really most of them are not his own credit. There's very little, if we think about it deeply, there's very little that we can really take credit for ourselves. If you would have grown up in Bangladesh, would you have been this top doctor? So you were born into a scenario that was supportive of you ending up being this doctor. Can we even take credit for our minds? Does a person have a choice if he's given an IQ of 150 or 50? Hey, we're not given a choice for that. Is that something we could take credit for? When a person is haughty, Chazal say he's taking credit for things that God gave him. He's not taking credit. There's very little that we have of our own. What is our own? If we're going to say that even our intellect is something as a gift that we were given, so what is our own? Any suggestions?
Our actions.
Our choice, our pirach of sheep. Our choice, our self-control. So in essence, when we talk about midot, we're talking about the area in life which we can really control. We can develop what kind of human being we will be. Now, even though a person can have predispositions, one person is born, he's an angry person. Another person has a tendency to be a lazy person. One of the basics that the Torah teaches us is that every one of us can grow. No one is limited. We can all develop. There's a medrash that says, there was once a very, very admired king out in the desert, and everyone had heard of what kind of person he was, what a kind, good, caring, giving person he was. So there was a king who lived some other continent. He wanted to discover, he wanted to see what this famous king looks like. So this king sends his officers to go and paint a picture and form a statue of this kind and generous king. They come back, his sculptors, his painters, they bring back a picture, they bring back a statue. He calls in his wise men, he says, analyze this picture and the sculpture. Tell me what kind of person is this? So they look and they say, okay, we come to the conclusion he's a miser,
he's a cruel person, he's a person who could have been a thief. They come back with all these negative traits. So the king says, okay, someone here is a liar. Either my wise men are worthless, or my painters and sculptors are worthless. But someone here is playing a game with me, because the king is famous for being such a kind king. So he packs his bags, takes his horses and rides out, crosses the continent to see this other king, to see who got it right, who's playing a game with him. So he comes and he asks to see this king. He comes in before that king and he says, okay, I see that my sculptors did an amazing job, my painters did an amazing job. I see they were right, must be my wise men are worthless. So this kind king asks him, what'd you come for? So he tells him the story. He tells him what happened. So the kind king tells him, now you know that the sculptors and the painters were right, but I'll tell you that your wise men were also right. So he says, what do you mean? He tells him, when I was born, those were the traits I had. My nature is to be angry. My nature is to steal. My nature is to kill. I have a very bad nature, but I overcame that nature. What your wise men saw were my natural tendencies. Yes, those are my natural tendencies, but I overcame them. That's why I have the reputation I have. One of the basics that the Torah teaches us is that every person has potential. Now the question is, how do we develop it? So part of it is also learning. There's a sefer called Mesilat Yesharim. You guys hear of it? Pathway of the Just. What he does is he takes the Talmud gives us an order in which a person can work on their own traits. He takes that order and explains how we work from one trait to the other, how we build our way up. Now for most people it's way too deep. They read it, but it's very hard to connect because we could barely get beyond the second trait. But it gives us a little bit of perspective how to build. I want to stand maybe with one thought. We read the story of Esther and it seems like, yeah, Esther was queen. She had potential to move Jewish history. Did we once discuss the difference between humans and herds? Cattle? David HaMelech was attacked by his father-in-law, Shaul. King Saul thought he was rebelling, and so he started chasing after him, trying to kill him. And many times David was almost caught. At one point, David HaMelech composed a verse, psalm in Tehillim, and he says, God, there are no one among Shaul's soldiers who's doing good. There isn't even one. And the question that's asked is, why, if there isn't anyone, it's obviously there isn't even one. Why does he stress that twice? When you see a shepherd and he has his herd, so each one of the oxen could take him apart. Shepherd isn't stronger than any single ox. And yet, the shepherd stands and he could guide 20 cattle and he runs the show. How does that work? So the idea is that cattle, each one assumes, if it's good for the other one, it's good for me. If they're all going in line, I'll go in line. They don't stop to think, is this what's right for me? But human beings are not allowed to be that way. Throughout our history, there are always individuals who changed Jewish history. All of the Jews bowed to Haman. Mordechai didn't. The Jews went to the feast of Ahasuerus, from which he took out the temple's vessels. Mordechai didn't. The Jews saw the destruction of the temple, and they didn't know where to go. Along came Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and he said, we have to write down the oral law. If we don't, it'll all be forgotten. We got to maintain it. The Jews came back to build the second temple. We're going back a little bit in history. And Ezra came along and said, we can't leave Judaism as unstructured as it's been until now. We have to put together a set Shmona Esrei prayer. Otherwise, Jews just won't pray. We see what's happened. The Jews will go astray. Shabbos can't look the way it's looked until now. We have to institute that people don't lift the objects they can't use. If people are going to carry around their cell phones, they'll end up talking on their cell phones. So came along one person, changed the course of Jewish history. Throughout our history, there were individuals who stood up and changed the course of history. Individuals. So David HaMelech, when he's being chased by his father-in-law, he says, there are no do-gooders. There's no one who's on my side among Shaul's men. But En Gam Echad, there isn't even one. Because he knew had there been even one, then everything would have changed. You guys are in a community where you keep telling me that there isn't that much Torah. Most people don't know that much, and there really aren't community leaders who can change the tide. But that makes it more incumbent upon you. It means that each one of you could be the one that's going to change the way Sweden looks. And it's not something that's impossible. I had a friend of mine who was... We studied together in yeshiva. He wasn't the top student. He was an okay student. And then he moved to a congregation that was holding by selling their shul to be a movie theater. No one was interested in coming to shul anymore. Everything was over. And there were literally, the shul was up for sale to sell it as a movie theater. There were bids going. And he came to the community and he made shul events. They'd go to... On Purim, let's say, so there was an event, everyone would come together on Purim, and on Chol HaMoed the whole shul would go to baseball games, and within 5 years he turned the whole community around. Suddenly the shul is a thriving place. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, sometimes all you need is a catalyst. You need one person to get things going. And I think you guys, you have 3 weeks left here. You have to start thinking, what can you take with you and what can you do, because there's no excuse. You guys are here. I mean, the rest of your communities are there. But who's going to turn the tide around? I could give you many stories from today's history. I mean, from the last decade of people, individuals. The story I told you now is a decade old. This story I'm about 15 years ago. But it's something that each of us can do. I mean, there was a guy who graduated yeshiva. He didn't know how to learn. All he knew how to do was read Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You guys know what the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is? Short version of halacha. That was all he knew. He moved to a community where no one knew that. So they appointed him rabbi. So he said, okay, we need to make a kosher butcher shop. How are we going to make a kosher butcher shop? So he calls the Orthodox Union, and he asked them, how do I set up a kosher butcher shop? So they directed him step by step how to do it, made a kosher butcher shop. Said, we need a kosher mikvah. How do we make kosher mikvah? Called up the Orthodox Union, they sat down a rabbi, and they put together a kosher mikvah. He changed the whole community around. He came to the community, there was no kosher meat, there was nothing. He didn't know that much. The guy couldn't read a Gemara. I mean, his community knew less than him. So he was the chief rabbi of the community, changed the whole community around. A person's knowledge has to be developed. A person shouldn't remain at the level that guy remained at. But at the same time, a person has to know that the potential to lead the community, especially bimkom she'ena nashim, you're coming to a place where there are no people. Ishtadel, strengthen yourself, liotish, to be the man. There's no one else there, then you have to be the one that's there. You know, that's, you guys are going to laugh, but it's the truth. It's part of the reason I'm sitting up here. I mean, if there were someone else, so I'd be their learner. But right now, I have to be here, so I'm here. But theoretically, most of the time that a person takes responsibility, it's because there's no one else right now who's going to take that responsibility. So in the time Mordechai and Esther, Mordechai tells Esther, if you're not going to do it, salvation may come from somewhere else, but who knows? Maybe this is your golden moment. Maybe this is the reason you were created. Any questions?